Deadly flooding spreads across much of Asia. It's Wednesday, July 17th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us, and you can join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, seeking to jumpstart North Korean talks, the politics of U.S. elections, the business of seeds and eels, Apollo 11's command center, trouble in the insect world. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Survivors scrambled for higher ground as torrential monsoon rain swept away homes and triggered landslides across South Asia Tuesday, with official counts of millions of people affected and at least 180 dead. The monsoon is crucial for irrigation and groundwater supplies in the impoverished region, home to a fifth of the world's population, and it brings relief after unforgiving summers. But the downpours, which stretch from June to September, can turn deadly and have wreaked havoc again this year across India, Nepal, Bangladesh, and Pakistan-administered Kashmir, with people, dwellings, and boats in remote low-lying areas washed away. In Mumbai, a building collapsed in a cramped neighborhood, killing seven people following heavy rains in the city. The state-run Flood Forecasting and Warning Center in Bangladesh says almost a third of the country was underwater. In Nepal, at least 78 people died and 16,000 families were displaced, although floodwaters have started receding. Images showed rescuers using inflatable dinghies to evacuate families trapped in flooded houses. Monsoons are nothing new to the area, but their frequency and intensity have increased. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about it with Michael Kugelman, Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center here in Washington, D.C.
The first thing to keep in mind here is that South Asia, the countries we're talking about, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, these are some of the most climate-vulnerable countries in the world, mainly because of their geographic position, in many cases low-lying states. A lot of densely populated coastal areas. So flooding can literally be a mass killer. And it certainly causes major economic damage and it displaces people. So, occasionally these things make headlines when you have these catastrophic events. But, it is very much a reality. It's something that we're going to be having to live with for quite some time. And I think the question is, are these countries taking the proper steps to mitigate against the problem? Now, one of the bright spots is that in Bangladesh, which is, I would say, perhaps one of the most climate-vulnerable countries in the world, Bangladesh has been running exercises involving its military in which they do these simulations of some type of natural disaster where you have large numbers of casualties and you have mass displacement, and you actually have these exercises that bring in the military. And they try to essentially address, come to the rescue and address this challenge. So I think it's not a bad idea. It certainly goes against the orthodoxy of what militaries are meant to do, particularly in democracies. But I think there's something to be said that, it sort of conveys this idea that climate change and natural disasters are a national security threat in so many of these countries in the region, not only in South Asia, but in large parts of the world.
Well, since we're talking about Bangladesh, they have a bigger population now if you count Cox's Bazar, which is housing tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees, and it's really reportedly hurting those people there. There are deaths. There are people who are just can't come out of their lean-tos if they're not destroyed. There's mud everywhere. How much more can they take?
Yeah, no, I mean, the Rohingya are just, it's one of the most tragic stories, and really one of the most underreported stories as well. You're right. I mean, I think Bangladesh has attracted a lot of praise for how it's been one of the few countries to actually take in large numbers of Rohingya refugees and actually treat them fairly well, of course, relatively speaking. You have many Rohingya who are in these camps and, in very bad conditions. And, there have been rumors that you would have a number of Rohingya in Bangladesh sent to this literally deserted island off the coast of Bangladesh that's never been inhabited. And it is wildly vulnerable to climate change. And I think we have this wake-up call in recent days about how real that threat of climate change is. So this idea of trying to improve the plight of Rohingya by easing issues of overcrowding, which you have in these camps in Cox's Bazar, sending them to this deserted island where there may be fewer people, but there would be a whole lot of other threats as well, one of them being climate change and flooding risks. It really is such a sad state of affairs.
Well, is there anything that can be done to alleviate this situation besides just saying this is the way it's going to be, it might get worse, and we just have to deal with it?
Yeah, well, no, we don't want to have to leave it at that. I think that the UN has tried to do a good job of getting more countries and entities to commit to more humanitarian assistance for the Rohingya, particularly in Bangladesh, where you have, several thousand that went into that country from Burma several years back. And if you could have more resources to be able to settle these folks in less crowded but still safe places that are not deserted islands, I think that would be an achievement. But unfortunately, we live in an era where donor fatigue is a big problem. And, I think that the UN has really struggled to meet a lot of its appeals, its humanitarian appeals, in terms of getting the money that it's tried to get. But I think that's where, you need an organization like the UN, one of the few global organizations that really has taken a strong commitment to ease the plight of the Rohingya in terms of the humanitarian challenges. So I think that we just have to hope that the UN is able to get more of the support and assistance that it really needs to try to improve the plight of these Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh and in all of the other countries that many of them have settled in.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Michael Kugelman, Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you log on online and visit voanews.com. Thailand's new cabinet sworn in, ending rule by army junta. Trump threatens to launch probe into Google's alleged ties with China. Activists say Duterte in crosshairs with new law on harassment. U.S.-South Korea drills could impact nuclear talks, say the North. Undersea quake near Indonesia's Bali causes panic and minor damage. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories with photos and videos, much more on Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. North Korea has criticized U.S. plans to hold a joint military exercise next month with South Korea, suggesting the drills could negatively impact upcoming working-level nuclear talks with Washington. In a statement from the Korean Central News Agency, North Korea's foreign ministry on Tuesday said the exercise violates an agreement reached last year by Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un in Singapore. The U.S. and North Korea agreed to hold working-level talks following a hastily arranged meeting last month between Trump and Kim at the demilitarized zone separating the two Koreas. A statement earlier in the day from the North's foreign ministry suggested that if the U.S. goes ahead with the exercises, Pyongyang could resume intercontinental ballistic missile and nuclear tests. North Korea views U.S.-South Korea military exercises as a preparation to invade. U.S. officials say the drills are necessary to deter North Korean attacks. Happening now in Asia, at least four people were killed when a four-story residential building collapsed Tuesday in India's financial capital, Mumbai. Dozens are trapped in the rubble. Efforts are underway to rescue people from the scene and from adjacent buildings, which are also deemed unsafe. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. In U.S. politics, the man who led the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, former special counsel Robert Mueller, is set to testify next week before two congressional committees in what could be a drama-filled appearance on live national television. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
Robert Mueller will testify before two U.S. House committees about his report on Russian interference in the 2016 election and possible collusion and obstruction of justice involving President Trump and his White House. In May, Mueller told reporters not to expect much beyond what is already contained in his report.
And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress.
Mueller concluded there was insufficient evidence of a criminal conspiracy or coordination between Russia and the Trump campaign to impact the election. But Mueller is likely to face numerous questions from Democrats about his decision not to render a judgment on whether President Trump engaged in possible obstruction of justice in connection with the Russia investigation.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. Under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office.
Oh, we had such luck.
President Trump has repeatedly tweeted about the report, and his mantra of no collusion, no obstruction has been a constant at his political rally.
For the last 2.5 years, we have been under siege. And with the Mueller report, we won. And now they want a do-over. They want a do-over. Let's do it again. Didn't work out too well. Let's do it again.
Democrats, including House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler, say they intend to press Mueller on the conclusions of his report.
The president joined in by repeatedly saying no collusion, no obstruction, which is not what the report found. So I think it's very important that the American people hear from Mr. Mueller as to what he did find, what the results of that 2-year investigation were.
The outcome of Mueller's testimony could have an impact on whether congressional Democrats push for an impeachment inquiry of the president, says analyst Andra Gillespie.
President Trump has survived the Mueller investigation. But, you know, I think, you know, it's an open question about whether or not Democrats would push for an impeachment, whether or not they could find additional evidence that might sway anybody's opinion one way or the other.
10 acts of obstruction. Act one.
The Mueller report has already taken on a life of its own among both the president's critics and his supporters. Hollywood actors recently staged a dramatic reading of the report at a performance in New York, with John Lithgow portraying President Trump.
But the president returned to the subject of Comey's job at the end of the dinner and repeated, "I need loyalty.
You will always get honesty from me.
That's what I want, honest loyalty."
Mueller's public testimony before the two House committees is expected to last for several hours. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, extracting Chinese plant oil just became easier. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte is considering cutting diplomatic ties with Iceland for leading a push to have the United Nations Human Rights Council investigate his brutal anti-drug crackdown. Amnesty International says the resolution is a crucial step toward justice and accountability. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for this and much more. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a new way to process Chinese plant oil and illegal trafficking of eels are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
A new technology developed by Xinhui Biotech is helping to develop the Camellia oleifera industry. Camellia oleifera is a plant cultivated in China whose seeds are pressed to produce oil. The new harvesting technology is being used in several townships across Longchuang County in Guangdong Province. Luo Yuzhu is an oil tea plant farmer from Zhangzhou Village.
We used to use traditional methods to peel oil tea grain here in our village. Now we are using new technology and have boosted our selling price. The new tech has brought us wealth. The automated technology simplifies the process.
Xinhui began their research and development 4 years ago. Now a single day of output with its technology equals around 100 days of human labor. The planting area of the tea has also doubled. China's promotion of Camellia oleifera cultivation has helped to alleviate poverty and address the country's urban and rural divide. Wang Tianyi is the first secretary of Zhangzhou Village.
Because this village has the tradition of planting oil tea camellia, we decided to make this the leading industry for poverty alleviation. Through joint efforts by the local government, we have transformed the village's infrastructure and appearance. Large-scale infrastructure development and road facilities have also been carried out. The effort has greatly improved the public facilities.
Xinhui is one of several companies developing shelling and drying technologies for the Camellia oleifera industry. Illegal trafficking of eels is on the rise. In June, the EU law enforcement agency Europol announced that 15 million endangered European eels had been seized in the preceding 12 months, a 50% rise from the year before. The illegal trade is now estimated to be worth around $3.7 billion a year. Andrew Kerr is the chairman of the Sustainable Eel Group.
You can get up to 100,000 glass eels in one suitcase. And if they're leaving Europe at a euro each, that's £100,000 in your suitcase. And then at the other end, you grow them on in a pond in China, and a year later, that's a million euros worth.
The European eel is classified as critically endangered by the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Flora and Fauna, but Europol says 300 to 350 million European eels are illegally trafficked from Europe to Asia every year. Eels are popular on menus in Japan, China, South Korea, and buyers will often offer up to 10 times their usual value if they can be shipped outside of the European Union. Ian Guildford is the investigative support officer at the UK National Wildlife Crime Unit.
It's getting very close to being the top. When you look at the monetary returns on the illegal market, yes, it is approaching one of the major wildlife crimes.
The export and import of European eels in and out of the European Union has been suspended since 2010, and Europol is working with Asian authorities to combat the illegal trade. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says he hopes both North Korea and the United States could be a little more creative as the two sides push to restart talks aimed at ending Pyongyang's nuclear program. Pompeo did not say when the negotiations would begin. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, on July 20th, 1969, American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin set foot on the lunar surface to become the first men on the moon. The U.S. space agency NASA is celebrating the 50th anniversary of this historic event in style by restoring and reopening the control room that handled the historic Apollo 11 mission. Today it is a museum, but it looks every bit alive and real as it did in 1969. Just as though engineers and scientists had stepped away for a moment. Licia Bacalets visited the control room. Anna Rice narrates her story.
The Eagle has landed. These were the first words mission control engineers heard from the moon as a new chapter in space exploration opened.
We've just landed on the moon. And the crew shuts down the engine, And now while the world celebrates, my team has to keep working because we have to make sure it is safe to remain on the surface of the moon.
The Mission Control Center in Houston managed space flights for another two decades. In 1992, the control team moved to a more modernized part of the space center and a historic room was closed.
So they cleaned up the stuff that was left in the consoles, get rid of the water bottles, Coke cans. There was stuff occasionally in the waste baskets that were around there. But basically, this place was not representative of historic mission control.
In 2013, a group of renovators won the contract to restore the room to the way it looked on July 20th, 1969.
35 interviews with the flight controllers, and they sat at each console and pointed out what buttons they interacted with the most and what they did at their console, and it really helped the restoration process to be able to figure out, you know, what was most important at that console.
The renovators spent 5 years doing meticulous research. The biggest challenge was restoring the consoles and making sure the big screens, the largest and most visual elements in the room, looked exactly as they did half a century ago.
Screen 1 and 2 and 5, for maybe over a year, we couldn't find out what was supposed to be on those screens during descent and landing. And after enough research, we finally got caught a break and found the right video that showed just a piece of what we needed to do to reconstruct it.
No detail was too small. The renovators found stationery from the late 1960s, as well as ashtrays, cigarettes, and soda cans. The restored Mission Control Center is open for tourists, who can see it through a large glass wall. For Леся Бакалец in Houston, Texas, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Without a doubt, insects are the most successful species here on Earth. They make up a clear majority of the world's 1.5 million total species, and they live almost entirely everywhere there is land, including Antarctica. But VOA's Kevin Enix tells us there is trouble in the insect world.
Insects are woven into the fabric of the planet. They are the most populous species on the planet and dinner for all kinds of animals.
Over 90% of songbirds actually need insects at some point in their life.
They are responsible for pollinating a third of the plants that produce our food and play a huge role in making sure all kinds of dead things decompose. But according to a new paper from the science-based nonprofit Xerces Society, the world's insects are in trouble.
But we've now started to see common species decline in many groups, in many of the groups that are studied.
Scott Black heads the Xerces Society, and he says the world's insects are suffering thanks to a triple blow of reduced habitat, pesticide use, and climate change.
Can you imagine having less habitat? You've got poisons in the environment, and now the climate is topsy-turvy. Spring may come really early, but then you have a late snowfall. We are having more droughts. We're having more major rain events. It's really the combination.
And this combination is putting stress on some of the world's most iconic insects.
Monarch butterflies. You know, everybody knows monarch butterflies. There used to be hundreds of millions of monarch butterflies, and they've declined significantly, likely 70-80%, even with this a good year in Mexico. And they've declined in the West by over 99%.
While we've known some of this information, the paper argues the pressure on the Earth's insects is increasing and says now is the time to start trying to fix the problem.
Similar to climate change, not acting is not going to be in the human interest. You know, we might eke by for the next decades like we will with climate change, but we're going to hit a tipping point where these ecosystem services really start to affect everyday life.
Black says the world needs to begin curtailing pesticide use, create more insect habitat, and aggressively begin to fight the worst effects of climate change. It's a costly fix, but one that Black says the insect world and the rest of the world may not be able to do without. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can hear us, of course, on VOA Asia Facebook each day and our website, voanews.com. If you happen to be in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, tune in to Helps Radio at Help University. You can hear our program there, too, and we thank everyone who's tuned in today. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Cedric Franklin, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower